Our fourth case this morning is numbers 07-1638, the United States against John Neal. Mr. Kamen.
Thank you. May it please the court. Richard Kamen for John Neal. Given that the burden of proof at a revocation of supervised release hearing is preponderance of the evidence, when the government chooses to pursue the supervised release revocation based upon an accusation of a new crime, and the defendant has not yet been convicted of that crime, the defendant, practical matter, has to prove his innocence to the district court. Even if he raises a reasonable doubt as to his guilt, that isn't enough. Because a reasonable doubt still would mean that there is some evidence justifying the arrest. And in Mr. Neal's case, the government did insist on, and the district court did insist on pursuing the supervised release violation prior to a conviction. The district judge ruled that Mr. Neal had no right to discovery of anything supporting the multiple levels of hearsay that supported, that made up the government's evidence. And additionally, the district court ruled as a blanket matter that Mr. Neal, that the case could proceed and Mr. Neal would have no right to any exculpatory evidence that might be in possession of either the government, the probation officer, or the state authorities who had brought the underlying criminal case. So it is very well possible that Mr. Neal has been sentenced to 2 additional years in federal custody based on multiple levels of hearsay, when the government or state authorities may have in their possession evidence showing he is not guilty.
Well, now, he admitted at least 2 of the violations, right? Failing to inform the officer of the state criminal charges and submitting false monthly reports to the officer.
He
admitted those, right?
He admitted 2 violations. What he admitted was that he took out a new line of credit without permission and filing false reports that I believe excluded certain bank accounts. That's
right.
Correct.
Right.
But what clearly drove the sentence was the notion that he had committed additional crimes, and that's clearly what drove the sentence.
The state or the government says that the, I quote, the items he sought were not used as evidence against him.
Everything that he sought underlied the supported the testimony.
And Neal acknowledges that the case law he cites in support of his motion deals with evidence used against the defendant in a revocation.
Yes, sir. For example, Officer McMahon testified about what he had been told that April Tackett had been told by somebody who supposedly worked for Neal. We wanted to see the underlying reports.
Why?
Because what had occurred, in Indiana state law, there's virtually open discovery. We had taken a
You're not in Indiana state law.
I understand. But we had taken a deposition of Officer McMahon prior to the supervised release hearing. His testimony in the deposition was at such variance with his testimony in the supervised release hearing, as we pointed out in our motion, that we felt that his testimony was either disingenuous or perhaps false. And the falsity would be demonstrated by the supporting documentation. If, for example, there is nothing in Officer Tackett's reports about the statement allegedly made by the person claiming to work for Neal, that would be important information to a district court, and it would be exculpatory under Giglio. Everything we sought was evidence that was referred to in one form or another by Officer McMahon. He talked at length about surveillance. He talked about trash pulls. He talked about all manner of things, and the evidence we sought was the evidence that supported, or more probably in some cases, didn't support what he was saying.
And was there evidence you sought about the discovery of the 36 gambling machines that were in his corporate headquarters of Video Services, which he was president of?
We sought police reports. We sought, if to the extent that that material may have been within those police reports, we would have sought that as well. Absolutely. The fact of the matter is that the justifications offered by the district court are simply, we believe, incorrect. The district court said there is a blanket matter. There is no right to discovery in a supervised release proceeding. And we think that is wrong when the charge is of a new crime for which the defendant has not been convicted.
Now, the charge was he violated his probation, the conditions of probation.
Absolutely. That was the underlying.
And he admitted that. So where are we going with this?
He admitted two of the violations, not three of them. There were three he contested.
It's kind of interesting, but I mean, why is that pertinent to the inquiry?
I'm sorry?
I said it's kind of interesting, but why is that pertinent to the inquiry?
Because I think it affects.
It's like being a little bit pregnant. Either are or you aren't.
Well,
if
he
violated the thing, he's going to get nailed. And the evidence seemed to me, in the leaving out what you're worrying about, seemed to be overwhelming.
The evidence of the two things he admitted absolutely was overwhelming. No question about that. But the sentence, it would be a completely different situation if he was sentenced to 2 years for failing to disclose a line of credit, or 2 years for not disclosing some bank accounts.
Whatever happened to the state case, by the way?
I'm sorry?
Whatever happened to the state case?
It has not yet been tried because he's in federal custody.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be tried till he's released from federal custody.
And, of course, you have no authority for the position you're taking here that he would be entitled to full discovery on a violation of supervised
release. We don't suggest full discovery.
Just Brady.
Certainly at a minimum Brady, and certainly when the government relies on police hearsay, the evidence supporting that hearsay, so that we could challenge it if appropriate. Absolutely.
Right. But you don't have any authority to support that.
Constitution, Your Honor.
Well,
and
yeah,
I don't mean.
Right. But I mean, you have no case law.
No case law specifically.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
The case is still pending in the state court.
Yes.
Have you asked? Do you represent him in the state court?
Yes, sir.
Did you ask them for exculpatory material?
Yes.
And they give you any?
Oh, yes.
Well, what do you want?
We've received it since this proceeding. We didn't have it at the time of this proceeding.
Did you file a motion to reopen or anything along those lines downstairs?
We have not, because of the pendency of the appeal.
I see.
And I will tell the court, and it's not in the record, that we have received extensive exculpatory evidence, which demonstrates that our fears were well-founded.
Thank you, Mr. Caven. We'll hear from Ms. McKee now.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm Christina McKee, the Assistant United States Attorney, who prosecuted the case, the criminal case that underlay this supervised release revocation hearing, and also represented the government at the supervised release hearing. It was not multiple layers of hearsay, I think, that caused Judge Tinder to revoke Mr. Neal's supervised release, Your Honors. It was instead the very extensive set of information that was provided to Judge Tinder. Copies of all of the government's exhibits were provided to Mr. Kamen prior to the hearing so that he was not ambushed by anything that happened.
What about all this material he's now received from the state?
I have not seen that, Your Honor, and cannot speak to what that material contains.
And it's not your practice to get such material when you're putting an agent on to testify, and he's going to basically testify to hearsay, not to have underlying reports and things?
No, Your Honor, what the agent testified to was the material that was contained in the state search warrant, and I relied on the observations that were contained in the state search warrant to support what the agent testified to for Judge Tinder.
So just it was the only thing he testified to was the material that had been received pursuant to the state, the search warrant.
And in addition to that, he testified to summaries of information that the state had obtained through subpoenas. Those were the bank records that Mr. Neal, the bank accounts that Mr. Neal had failed to disclose to his probation officer, the summary of the, I think, $1.5 million that was contained in those bank accounts that he had not disclosed to his probation officer.
So there was no other source of his testimony other than documents you received from the subpoena and items seized from the search warrant. He didn't testify to anything else.
He testified to what he had observed during the state investigation, what he had learned during the state investigation. The United States did not issue subpoenas for the supervised release hearing, relied on information that was provided to us by the state that they had gotten as a result of state subpoenas for the underlying criminal investigation.
But I guess my question is, did he testify to anything he had learned that witnesses had said from the state or anything like that? Because what counsel's saying is that he did get materials from the state eventually. And he's saying that some of that was exculpatory information. So I'm trying to determine, you know, what he testified to and what the basis of that testimony was.
He testified to what he had observed during his own observations as a surveillance officer during the course of the investigation.
Not hearsay, but he saw it.
Yes, sir. And he also testified to what other state investigators had seen and told him. That was hearsay, Your Honor, during the course of the state investigation. Now, that officer's name, Officer Tackett, was identified in court. She was identified, and Mr. Kamen knew her name from the deposition he had taken. You may recall from the record that Judge Tinder set a second hearing and offered Mr. Kam and Mr. Neal the opportunity to present additional evidence at that hearing.
That was the point where he requested, now that he knew Tackett, he wanted to get the reports from Tackett.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. You didn't have those in your possession.
No, Your Honor, I did not.
You didn't ask to get them in your possession.
No.
Because even in a regular criminal trial, you know, once a witness testifies, the defense is entitled to see the prior statements of the witness. You agree with that, or the police reports or something?
Yes, Your Honor, but I did not have those. And I'll also note that Mr. Kamen did not bring Officer Tackett to the second hearing, as he could have done. He brought the person who she alleged made comments saying that Mr. Neal was running the gambling business. That's the David Snow who testified at the hearing, whom Judge Tinder found to be incredible when he denied having made those statements. So I think the point is that Mr. Neal would like the court to think that what he went back to prison for 2 years on is a bunch of unsupported hearsay. What he went back to prison on, Judge Tinder said, is Judge Tinder's well-founded, based on the evidence, belief that Mr. Neal simply came back out of prison and began again to run the same gambling operation he'd been sentenced to the first time. Judge Tinder based that belief on the 100 of the CPU boards, the motherboards that control gambling devices that, as the court noted, were found in Mr. Neal's business headquarters, much as they had been the first time we went through his process with Mr. Neal.
And then was the officer who testified at the revocation hearing, was he there when the search took place at the office? I'm just curious.
No, Your Honor, he was not. He was present at Mr. Neal's residence when I think it was $1.6 million was recovered that Mr. Neal had hidden, some of it in the basement shower that had been converted to look like a cedar closet with fire safes behind the cedar walls where he kept the cash. It's interesting to note that at no time did Mr. Neal, or any of his representatives offer an explanation. Judge Tinder questioned, it was obvious he was concerned about, how did a man who got out of prison in 2004, by the fall of 2006, how had he accumulated $3.5 million in cash? Part of that cash maintained at his home, part of it in bank accounts he failed to disclose to his probation officer. The judge found that troubling, and the only explanation he found credible of this instance was that Mr. Neal was once again part of this very extensive gambling business that he had prohibited Mr. Neal, as part of his supervised release conditions, from participating in. And so based on that, we turn to the question of, was 2 years an unreasonable, plainly unreasonable sentence? And I think Judge Tinder made clear, having evaluated the 3553 factors, it was not.
Let me ask you about that, because I think there might be a problem with the statutory maximum sentence. It looks to me like the maximum was 2 years, not three. The statute generally says that he can get up to 3 years, since that was the term of his supervised release, but it goes on to say that the court can impose more than 2 years if the underlying offense was a Class C or D felony. So Neal pled guilty to felonies with 5-year statutory maximums, making them Class D felonies. Isn't that what he did?
Yes, Your Honor.
So then shouldn't the maximum then on the supervised release be a 2-year term? The district court clearly thought it was a 3-year term, and he explicitly said that he wanted to go below the maximum by giving 2 years. So that's a problem if he was only eligible for the max.
I must confess to the court, I thought the maximum was 3 years, like the district court. I did not understand it to be two. I requested 3 years at the time of the hearing. I think what Judge Chinda was saying is he wanted to give Mr. Neal the benefit of considering his age and health circumstances. He did that. Even after considering those things, he found that 2 years was the appropriate sentence, given the very serious extent of Mr. Neal's.
Well, the section I was looking at is 3559A4. Which, you know, classifies the type of felony and looks at the statutory maximum. And so if that's true, then that could be a problem.
I understand, Your Honor. I cannot comment on that further. I don't think that Judge Chinder intended to do anything other than send the very message to Mr. Neal that his violations were very significant. I think he said he had thumbed his nose at the court and indeed at the entire concept of supervised release by his actions. So while Judge Chinder might have thought 3 years was the maximum, I think he still would have thought that 2 years was the appropriate sentence for Mr. Neal, because he did take into account not only the events that had occurred, but also Mr. Neal's personal conditions with regard to his health and his age.
But you agree that it could be plain error if the court thought the max was three, said he wanted to go below the max by giving him two. There's a possibility that it could be plain error.
There is a possibility of that, Your Honor. The court said no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. McKee. How much time does Mr. Kamen have? Thank you.
If the court will look at the testimony of Officer McMahon, we'll see page after page after page where he is alluding to things that were done by other officers. Sometimes secondary hearsay, sometimes other officers heard from other officers. Whenever we had the information to challenge him, the court will see that often his testimony was overstated. Now, we issued subpoenas to the state between the hearings, or to the state, for the underlying information. Those subpoenas were quashed. And the testimony of Officer Hackett, without benefit of her notes, is useless to us when we have to prove our innocence. The next best thing, and then I'll stop on this point, was to call the witness who supposedly said certain things, and he said he didn't say that. Obviously, I'm out of time.
Well, you have a few minutes, or until the red light.
I thought it was the red light.
You're down to about 30 seconds.
Okay. Unless the court has any questions, we could go on and on and on about the multiple levels of hearsay, and that's really the problem here. Mr. Neal had to try and prove his innocence of an unconvicted crime without the tools to do that. The major tool being exculpatory evidence, and when the government relies on hearsay, the evidence supporting that.
And let me ask you this. If we were to affirm the district court, would you be in a position to go to the district court now that you have those statements and ask for a rehearing on it?
I honestly don't know what the law is as to whether or not a supervised release proceeding can be reopened. I might be reduced to trying to file something under 2255. I honestly don't know the answer to that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kamen. Our thanks to both counsel in the case.